Hey there, kids. This is the Bat Commander, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer. Get on it!
Well, hey there, cadets. If you like records, point your interweb browsers to audiophileusa.com, where you can dig through their huge inventory of excellent and near-mint vinyl records. That's what they do. Simply the best records shipped anywhere in the world to you. Over 42,000 titles in stock. Jazz, rock, classical, funk, soul, pop, prog, punk, psych, and more at audiophileusa.com. Sign up for their mailing list and get first dibs on new stuff. That's audiophileusa.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. Oh yeah, and don't forget to clean your records. Groove Washer is the best record cleaner in heaven, earth, or that hot spot where that red guy with the pointy stick does his business. And now, introducing the new Mondo Groove Washer Bundle, a gorgeous discounted bundle that will keep your records clean and happy for years. Plus, here's a 10% off discount code, VinylGuide10 at checkout. That's the Mondo Groove Washer Bundle and more, available at groovewasher.com. Promo code VinylGuide10. And with that, let's start today's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Ah, well, hey there, peoples. I hope you're well. I hope you're safe. I certainly hope you're doing okay. This is Nate from The Vinyl Guide, and wow, it has been a heavy, heavy year, and it doesn't appear to be getting over by a long shot. As I speak, there are huge fires in California. My old neighborhood near Santa Cruz seems to be in danger, possibly even gone, so I don't know what to say to my old neighbors and friends other than to just be safe out there, be strong, look after one another. This week, hopefully, we'll bring a bit of joy into everyone's homes and smartphones. We're talking with the MC Bat Commander himself, founder of the Aquabats, and Yo Gabba Gabba, Mr. Christian Jacobs. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the Aquabats, do yourself a favor and Google them up, because they are an absolutely wonderful band. They've created this tremendous universe for kids and adults alike. I discovered them in the late 90s, became a bit obsessed with them for a period of time, and managed to follow their adventures up to this very day. Now, the Aquabats do an absolutely delightful job of bringing music and entertainment to a family audience, and I'm proud to say I have raised a few boys having the Aquabats universe part of our universe. Now, what you're listening to now is the short interview. We've got an extended, much longer interview with Christian available to our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. Join us there, help support the show. You'll get immediate access to extended interviews, bonus episodes. That's up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. What you're about to hear on the show today, Christian shares the history of the Aquabats, their punkish beginnings, the vinyl, the collectibles, how the Aquabats Super Show came to be, their show props, the creation of their personas, and much, much more. And if you head up to our Patreon page, get the extended interview, you'll get more stories, more history, more details, more fun stuff, and it's just there for our show supporters at patreon.com/vinylguide, and thanks in advance for your support. And finally, if you like this interview, we've got a ton of other episodes of The Vinyl Guide that await your earholes, such as episode 235, 40 Years of Bad Religion with Jay Bentley, discussing the history of Bad Religion, their records, and much more. That's episode 235 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 229, Frontier Records with Lisa Fancher. Lots of great LA punk and vinyl tales there. Episode 219 with Matt Cameron of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, talking records, music, and much more. Episode 198 with the one, the only, Dr. Demento, talking about record collecting, funny music, and more. And one for the Way, Way Back Machine, episode 64, featuring a conversation with Angelo Moore of the legendary Fishbone. All episodes of The Vinyl Guide are available from our apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And with that, the upfronts are done. Let's get straight into the interview with the MC Bat Commander himself, Mr. Christian Jacobs of the Aquabats. Hey there, kids. This week, we are welcoming to the Vinyl Guide the MC Bat Commander himself, Mr. Christian Jacobs, celebrating the new Aquabats LP, Kooky Spooky, in stereo. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Christian.
Hey, thank you, Nate. This is fun. This is really fun.
And we've only just started, too. Now, yeah. I've been a huge fan of the Aquabats for many years now, and I'm not sure I would still qualify as an Aquabat cadet. Is there a term for an older fan?
We should make one up. Yes, there is. We just haven't made it up yet.
An aqua codger. That's what I am. Yeah.
I heard you say aquagerian, but that we're getting close on that one.
Too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll definitely be there at some
aqua
point.
Aqua codgers sound pretty good. Yeah. a geezer, it might be a good too.
Aqua geezer, yeah, I could go for that too. Now, obviously, the show's about music, but you've created two wonderful TV shows that have music really as a central theme: the Aquabat Super Show and Yo Gabba Gabba. And really, Christian, you weave the music in such a way into the shows. The way it's done for kids is absolutely delightful. So, what role did music play in your life as a kid?
You know, it was a big one. It had a lot of impact on me and my decision makings, as it does for many people. I don't really feel like my experience is super, super duper unique, but I think growing up in LA and Los Angeles in the time that I did, where, you know, new music and I don't know, like a revolution of rock and roll was happening. Right at the perfect age for me to be kind of tuned into radio stations like KROQ from Pasadena, and that was bringing in, you know, all, you know, Rodney Bingenheimer was bringing in all kinds of music from England and, you know, punk rock and new wave, and but also just stuff my parents listened to. My dad had this box of old 45s and 7 inches, and he just kind of threw it to the wolves, like said, you guys can have it, to the kids. And we would listen to his old, you know, Beatles records and old 50s songs and music. And so between that and listening to the radio, driving to school, you know, music always had a really big influence on my life and decisions made, you know, for sure.
Were you playing instruments at all, or were you mainly just listening and consuming?
Yeah, my parents wanted me to play the piano, so they, you know, got me piano lessons. And of course, I wanted to play the drums, or I wanted to play guitar. I didn't want to be a piano player. And so, you know, I kind of pushed against it pretty hard. And once my parents got divorced when I was about 14, then it was like my mom just kind of gave up trying to make me do anything. she just threw in the towel. Like, that's it. You're done. Which I think any recently divorced mom might feel the same way. But yeah. So there. And then you know, going to church and singing was a big thing for our family. Music was a big thing in our family. Singing songs and singing in church, which kind of gives you a foundation for music, whether you kind of realize it or not. It helps you understand pitch and tone and staying on key, you know? So all that stuff kind of played into it, but mostly I think television, you know, the variety shows were a dime a dozen at that like golden age of watching TV, when, you know, the mid 70s, late 70s, Donnie and Marie, Sonny and Cher, you know, Sid and Marty Krofft had all kinds of things going on variety wise. And just music was like such a big part of entertainment.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Because the guests would come out and they do a little bit of slapstick, and then they'd break into a song at some point in the show. And yeah, it seemed natural then. It seems really odd now.
It's totally seems weird now, but it was really selling you on these personalities that were also, you know, multi-talented. And I think that was kind of the like idea, was to create celebrities that could not only sing, but they could act, they could be funny, they could do everything. And it seemed like the mid to late 70s was the height of that, where anyone you watched on TV was not only a singer, but there was a songwriter, they were an actor, they could fly planes, you know, it was like these super people.
They weren't on TV unless they were a triple threat. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And that's kind of a weird thing to think about now, where it's odd now, but it seemed like it made so much sense back then.
It seems to me, just following the career of the Aquabats, there in the early days, there was a little bit more, I won't call it darkness, but there's a little bit more chaos. For example, like right now, you wouldn't release a song called Revenge of the Midget Punchers, because no. I would imagine that is outside of the Aquabats universe.
Yeah, for sure. And even that was in reference to, we were really reactive to the scenes and to what was happening in punk, the punk scene, and in the ska scene. And the Aquabats were in the spirit of punk rock, we were trying to do something that was reactive to, mm-hmm. like you go to a ska show and there would be like 30 guys like punching the same way towards the ground, and that's the skank or whatever. It was like a very uniform thing. It was very, no one had any variety. That, you know, when you watch old 60s videos of Desmond Dekker or like ska in Jamaica, you see there's like different styles and people are dancing differently. They're not just violently punching towards the ground. And that's kind of where that term Revenge of the Midget Punchers came from. But even that name is insensitive too. And we were coming from being in punk bands and looking at how everyone was trying so hard to be tough and hardcore. And even in the ska scene, it was very like, it was almost like a gang, you know, like we're ska, you want to fight. And we thought that was just, everything was kind of ridiculous, but the way to counter it was to do something that was like, hey, we're a kid show and we're superheroes and we're silly and everyone brush your teeth, and just to get a reaction out of people. And it did. I mean, we played with a lot of punk bands, like hardcore bands, and people, they really hated us, like, because we were doing something that was quote unquote squeaky clean. And we just got a kick out of being, I guess, contrarian, you know, like, which I thought was punk.
I mean, it seems like the Aquabats were influenced, I mean, certainly by music, also by television shows like Banana Splits, H.R. Puffin and stuff. At what point were the visuals and aesthetics of the Aquabats important to the band? Was that the discussion? Was that there from day one?
Yes and no. We had a bunch of friends in different bands, and we were like, hey, let's do a ska band just kind of as a silly joke. And we had one practice. We wrote four songs. And at the show, our trumpet player, who worked at a wetsuit factory, he brought in those rubber helmets that we still wear today. And he said, hey, I made these helmets. They're like Buck Rogers helmets. So we can be kind of like Devo, like a Devo ska band, because his favorite band was Devo. Mm-hmm. And we thought that was great. And then that's where the idea started to kind of solidify. But yes, looking different from the beginning was a very important thing. And so it went from that, where we weren't expecting there to be really anything. And then suddenly, you know, Boyd, our trumpet player, said, "What? Let's wear these like Devo." And then for the next maybe 10 shows, every show we wore something different, but we wore those helmets. So we would be bakers one show, we would be doctors or firemen, but we always had those helmets on underneath. Like, having a uniform was important. So I think similarly around that time, the surf, kind of resurgence of the early 90s surf bands like the Mummies and the Phantom Surfers, and to an extent, like even Rocket from the Crypt and things like that, they were bringing back the like uniformed rock bands, you know? So we were kind of getting in on that as well. And then one show, we finally got it all kind of clicked with the rash guards and the shorts and the superhero vibe. And then then from that point forward, it was like, okay, this is the most, this is the most ridiculous thing we could wear at a punk show is superhero outfits. So let's just stay with this is what it became.
And then just, you know, playing into it, even with the interaction with the audience, telling them to drink their milk.
Yes.
That sort of thing. Yep. It became,
yeah, okay, you know, be healthy, kids. And again, at the time, superheroes were so nerdy. And I, you know, I grew up reading comic books and watching tons of Spider-Man and all the Marvel shows. And so to kind of like give way to that or admit to that while you're trying to be a cool punk rocker was super nerdy. But again, it went back to the ethos. Like, what is punk rock? Isn't it going against the grain? And isn't it trying to get a reaction out of people? And so we were just doing it in a very like kind of forced G-rated kind of a thing that actually made people upset, which is like, well, we're doing something right. Let's keep doing it.
Now, each member has this persona. And of course, ska bands at the time, I think you at one point, Aquabats were 8 people.
Yeah.
When a new member comes in,
that was that first show, yeah.
Yeah, how do you give them a new identity? Do you work with the elements of who they are, their ideas? Like, how do you develop someone like a Crash McClarson or a Eagle Bones Falcon Hawk?
Well, in the beginning, you know, we all just came up with names kind of on the spot. So Crash made up his name because he always wanted to be Crash. Like, he wanted to, he wanted that to be his name on his birth certificate. So he just loved that nickname. So Crash was easy. I was the Caped Commander in the beginning because I used to wear a cape, and that was kind of what set me apart from the rest of the band, is the guy with the cape is the singer, you know? And so, but then once the masks and helmets, it became more uniform, I just became the Bat Commander. And then gradually, because of my love of all things hip hop, the MC Bat Commander. So, okay. Which doesn't make any sense because I'm a terrible MC, but you know, and the other guys like Jimmy the Robot was a TV reference, you know, referencing Jaime the Robot from Get Smart. And Catboy was, you know, his real name is Boyd. So he had Boy in his name already, and he just liked cats. So Catboy, it was easier in the beginning, but when Ricky Fitness replaced our drummer, Dr. Rock, who replaced Travis Barker, aka the Baron Von Tito. And Tito, like, Travis had a hard time thinking of a name because he wasn't really like super, I guess, that kind of playful. But right, his friends called him Tito, and he always kind of seemed like Snoopy the Red Baron, like behind his drums, where he was kind of always having his own adventures on the side, you know?
Okay.
So that's where kind of the Baron Von Tito came from, is Travis was, because he was his own dude, you know? He was doing his own thing, and he was so talented drum-wise. Anyway, so yeah, it got a little trickier, but Eagle Bones Falcon Hawk, you know, Ian Fowles, his last name is Fowles, like birds, so we knew it had to have something with birds in it, and then because he's so skinny, it just seemed like Eagle Bones made sense, you know. And then Ricky, he was, at the time he joined the band, he was in really, really, really good shape just by nature of, and he, you know, he's a good looking guy. So I thought of like a character from TV, if you remember the Slim Goodbody.
Slim
guy.
Goodbody. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Who was he was the purveyor of health. But he wore this like leotard that showed all his like insides on the outside. Remember?
Yeah. Look, kids, this is the intestine. Yeah.
It was so gross and weird. And he had this perfect perm, like a permed haircut. Anyway, the things we watched. But that's kind of where the Ricky Fitness character came from, was like a perfectly healthy guy where we were all a little and unhealthy, and we were already kind of getting into dad bod zone at that point too, so
you've got these internal band characters, and then you make even their nemeses, the Sand Fleas, Silver Skull, this whole Aquabats universe. Like, in terms of I don't know, this is very nerdy, but do you document, do you have some sort of guide as to what belongs in the Aquabats universe and what doesn't? Or is that just kind of all in your head and you just kind of wing it as you go?
It's more of a winging it thing. But there are things that just seem like they don't belong. And I think the reference point comes from a lot of stuff that we, again, grew up and the seeds planted in our mind gardens, if you'll go with me down a strange pathway. But, you know, the stuff from the 60s that was rerunning heavily when we were kids and just comic books and that, you know, Silver Age comics, Jack Kirby stuff. And there's stuff that fits, I guess, referentially and tonally, but any stuff that's, and then there's stuff that just doesn't really fit. And I think a lot of it has to do with aesthetic as well as the time period. You know, the 60s was something when the Aquabats started, was something we were really, really into celebrating. And whether that was the ska music from the 60s or surf music or, you know, experimental rock and roll, like, and even bands that, you know, the Stingrays and Paul Revere and the Raiders and bands that had themes. Mm-hmm. So if it feels like, you know, the Sand Fleas feel like you look at them and that it could exist in the 60s, or, you know, they're like a surf band's nemesis, you know? And so I think the 60s does play a lot into the decisions that ended up coming into the band. But, and, you know, even old Batman, like the 66 Batman, has such a huge influence on me and on the aesthetic of the band as well, whether people realize it or not. I mean, a lot of people do, but some people have no idea. And you know, I think it's that time period still goes into the decision-making about what becomes a bad guy. And also, you know, a ton of Japanese tokusatsu stuff and Ultraman and that's all 60s, you know, that's all coming from the 60s. So the 60s was, I think, for pop culture, such a so much more influential than maybe people actually give it credit for. I mean, it was like the renaissance of pop, pretty much. It was the 60s.
Well, and those shows were, we were inundated with them in the 70s. I mean, with only 3 or 4 channels to choose from, there was a lot of reruns in the middle of the day. There's a lot of latchkey kids like ourselves who, you know, we consumed probably 5 or 6 hours of television a day watching these reruns over. And then now we're, quote unquote, in charge of the world. And so, yeah, that absolutely, you know, made an indelible mark in each of our brains.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And thank you for recognizing as a fellow latchkey kids.
Yeah,
that's true. It's true. And it's hard for the next generation and especially the iPhone generation to even understand all that stuff. And so, you know, I don't really bother trying to explain it. I'm just trying to roll with the punches now. But
yeah,
it's just a really different world.
Well, I think our generation is probably going to be one of the last generations that's really into collecting and these sort of physical possessions. Because right now you've got, you know, kids who have on-demand music and video. Any movie they want to see, they could pretty much watch it at any time. Any song they want to dial up, no problems. For us, it was, oh God, we listened to the radio and try to capture it on a cassette if we were lucky, or if we were able to scrape together some money, maybe buy the record if we could find it.
Exactly. And I think that is huge, that goes into the psyche of the collector generation, is because if you saw something on TV like Destroy All Monsters with, you know, Godzilla and Rodan and King Ghidorah and all, you could only see it maybe once a year it would come on. Mm-hmm. And if you missed it, you missed it. And so, or any, you know, anything like that, even just Speed Racer coming on, it came on at 6:30 in the morning in LA. And if you didn't get up and you didn't see it, you couldn't go back and watch it again. You missed it. And so you'd go to school and kids would be talking about, oh, did you see Speed Racer today? I'm like, no, what happened? I missed it. I slept in. And they're like, oh, this had, you know, and it entertainment was, it seemed more valuable because it was less
disposable, I guess. It was more, you had to really plan for it and research it and look for it. And so, you know, if there was toys or collectibles or things that came from it, it just felt so much more valuable, I think, to the new kids generation, for sure. I can totally see that. Even in my own kids, like, they were into collecting stuff for a while, probably based on their dad being such a freak about it, but they just don't even care anymore. They don't even care about stuff like that, collecting, because they can collect Pokemons on their Pokemon Go, you know, like, they just go out and play Pokemon Go, and I got what I need. I don't need a tangible one. I need more digital points, right? Which, again, for me, doesn't feel as valuable as something you can actually hold on to. Yeah. So I still have a ton of VHS tapes and a ton of DVDs that I just can't get rid of them, because I feel like, well, when they unplug the machine, I'll have all the DVDs.
I'll be able to spend the rest of my life watching these movies that I can't find time to watch right now.
Right, or that there's no power to watch the DVD player.
So what is it you collect? Do you collect records? Do you collect figures? What is the wing of the house, the collecting wing, like?
I am a silly collector, and I go through phases where I'm like really into collecting something, and then I think that's how kind of most collectors are. And recently, actually, I started collecting some records again. I lived in Japan when I was 19. I went to and lived in Japan, and I did a missionary work and I taught English. And when I left and I came home, my records had been pilfered. Like, my friends had come over and taken a bunch of my records, and they were gone. And my kid brothers had loaned them out to people. And I would have been upset, but I was on a little different kick at the time. So I was like, yeah, whatever, I don't care. But recently I've been collecting records a little bit again, but I collect, you know, Japanese toys and comic books, blacklight posters, movie posters. I was collecting surfboards for a while, but that got a little too stupid, expensive. Some old skateboard stuff, punk rock flyers, and records. So I've kind of started collecting some of the old records that I had that went missing 20 years ago.
Which ones were those? What are the ones that you're hoping to get back, or the ones you recently replaced?
So, like, recently, some of my Dead Kennedys records and 7 Inches that I had that went missing. Some of the Discord records from, like, Minor Threat and the DC, you know, some Bad Brains stuff. So it's, like, mostly punk rock stuff. I got an Aggression record that went missing. I just got that in the mail a couple weeks ago. And Aggression's a band from Oxnard in California. They're a hardcore punk band from the 80s. And, you know, so just looking at stuff like that. But then also, you know, I never had any classic stuff from my era on vinyl. So, like, Pixies stuff or Devo stuff. I think I had a couple Devo records back in the day, like Freedom of Choice and Oh No It's Devo. So most of the stuff I had in the 80s was on cassette.
Right.
And then I think, yeah, some of my Specials records were missing. So I got some of my ska stuff back, Selector, Special, the Fishbone's first record, which is a classic.
Gotta have that.
You have to have it. So I got another one of those, and as I was flipping through my record collection, I found my old one. So I have two, my original one and then a better copy. But yeah, going back and thinking about all these, you know, Oingo Boingo stuff, I didn't have any Oingo Boingo vinyl, but I had it all on cassette. And then when CDs came in, I started collecting CDs. So all of the, you know, pre-grunge era Sub Pop stuff and SST stuff, like Dinosaur Jr. and Sonic Youth and all that stuff, I had either on CD or cassette. So some of that stuff, it's been fun to kind of go back and find deals on vinyl and find those records on vinyl.
Now, Aquabats, the musical output was largely, well, started kind of mid-90s, so vinyl was pretty well phased out at that point. But there are a few collectible items in the catalog. I'm thinking about the picture discs.
The picture discs.
Tell us the story about the picture discs.
So we, you know, Paul Tillett, who he was the president of Golden Voice, which was a promotion company in the 80s, which they should do a documentary about that because that's a pretty amazing story. And they talk a little bit about it in the Coachella 20 Years in the Desert documentary, which if you haven't seen it and you're into music, you've really got to see that because it's really awesome. Paul, he was a promoter, and he wanted to sign some bands and start a label, Golden Voice Records, because Golden Voice was kind of like the company that promoted all of the cool shows, all the good shows. So punk shows, hip hop shows. If Nick Cave came to town, Golden Voice was the company. If Black Flag was playing, Golden Voice was the company. If Run DMC was going to be here, Golden Voice would promote it. It was all kind of like the underground music. And he wanted to start a label, and he came to us after a show one night that Golden Voice had promoted and said, "Hey guys, you know," and I'll never forget this. He said, "I've always wanted to start a label, and there was a band that I used to book all the time, and I was going to start a label, and I didn't do it because I was afraid or whatever. I didn't think I could pull it off, but I really wanted to start a label with that band, and I haven't felt the same way about a band since until I saw the Aquabats play tonight." And he's like, "I want to start a label, and I want you guys to be the first band on my label, because you got the way you make me feel is like, this is something else. This is something different." And we were super flattered because Paul, you know, he's a legend and just a great guy, and everyone loves him, and he's legendary, you know? And so we said yes. And that, when I was like, "Well, out of curiosity, what was the other band?" And he said, "No, it was No Doubt." And we were like, "Wow, that's a huge compliment." So he started the label, and at the same time, he was launching Coachella at the same time. And the first Coachella, they kind of lost their shirt on. And so the first thing to get the axe was the record business. Yeah. So we had released one album, or we released the first album, The Fury of the Aquabats, through Golden Voice. And then we started releasing the picture discs, and the picture discs were, I take it back. We started writing songs, and then our next record, The Floating Eye of Death, the Aquabats versus The Floating Eye of Death, we were in the studio, and I think the day the record came out, was the same date of Coachella, the first Coachella. Mm. And it just kind of sunk the whole thing. So promotion went out the window, and we had the picture discs coming out. We're slotted to start coming out because they featured some singles from the new record. And the eight were supposed to come out, and I think only four came out, or five?
Four, I believe four, yeah.
Yeah, four came out. Yeah, eight were supposed to come out, and only four came. So there was supposed to be a picture disc for every Aquabat, like, that was in the band at that time. And there was eight guys in the band at the time. Only four came out because of Coachella. So Coachella tanking actually tanked the label. They said, "Sorry guys, we're closing the label down, and we love you, but it's over." So the four picture discs that we had designed and ready, they were ready to come out, but they never got printed. So the four that came out are pretty rare because no one really promoted. They weren't promoted. They just kind of floated a little bit. Some people bought them. I think I have one of each, but that's it. And so even the band members, I don't know if many of the band members even got them. And the Bat Commander picture disc never came out. That was the one that was supposed to come out last, you know, so that people would want to collect all eight in the set or whatever. But yeah, that's the only vinyl we ever put out until just recently. So
I imagine the pictures and the artwork and everything was done. It just needed even test pressings, maybe of those four that didn't come out.
I don't know. Yeah, like if there were test pressings, Golden Boys, they would have them, and if they knew where they were, that would be really cool. But I doubt it.
Do you right now control all the Aquabats catalog, all the years of the Aquabats, or are there gaps in what you control, what you manage?
For the most part, yes. There's a couple of gaps. For instance, Charge, the record that came out.
Nitro.
Nitro is not a label anymore either, and then the rights to that I think switched over to Bug Music or something to do with BMI, and we're trying to get to the bottom of that. Fearless Records also, there's the return of the Aquabats, which is like our first CD that we put out, which they have a production deal on. I mean, we put that out ourselves and they came in and did a production and a manufacturing deal for that, and they've been producing it ever since. But that record, the Myths and Legends album, and High Five Soup are under Fearless, and so and Fearless has changed hands a few different times too, and so those records in particular, High Five Soup, Myths and Legends, and the return of and Charge, like those four records are, we're trying to get the rights back, but everything else we got the rights back. Golden Voice gave us the rights back after, you know, 15 years. Paul gave me a call one day and said, "Hey, you should have these. These are yours." And he just gave them to us.
That's like, brilliant.
Yeah, just because he's a great guy. And that's why people love Paul Tillett, because he's a real guy. He's a good guy. Mm-hmm. And then the Super Show, we got the rights back to the Super Show as well. So the Super Show soundtrack we control, and then everything else. So it's those four records are still floating a little bit.
I've noticed all the Super Shows are now on your YouTube. So you also control the video as well. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Now with Kooky Spooky in stereo, when you're going into an album or recording cycle like this, do you think about, okay, well, let's develop some collectability around some of the items, like a few limited edition things here or there? Is that in the wheelhouse at all? Or is
yeah,
it-
for sure. So there's a vinyl record, a vinyl version of Kooky Spooky. Because it's crowdfunded, these two new records, we're working on the second one right now. But Kooky Spooky was crowdfunded through a Kickstarter. And so when you joined a certain tier of the Kickstarter, you become a member of the Legion of Righteous Comrades. So there is a version of the vinyl that's stamped for the Legion of Righteous Comrades. It has a different color scheme. I think the actual vinyl itself is glow in the dark. So that one is a special one just for the club of people that donated and basically produced the record. It's because of them we could do it. So we did a special version of the record for them. And then we did a special, or then there's just a regular retail version of the record, which looks like the CD. And it's the same colorway. It's the same everything. But I think there are going to be a couple of special vinyl colors that will come out in addition to those two releases. And then we're working on, I'll announce it, but and we haven't told anybody, but we did two songs off the record in Japanese, and we're going to do a Japanese release that's going to be a 7-inch that will be the Japanese versions of two songs on the record.
Oh, okay. So a little 7-inch, maybe with an obi strip or anything like that? In the
Yeah. We want to do the Japanese, like the obi strip on the side. Yeah, sure.
That's awesome. So how does one, this is probably a good time to remind everyone to go to theaquabats.com, where they can find all sorts of information and pick up a copy of Kooky Spooky in stereo. Of course, there's vinyl, there's CDs. You can go to theaquabats.bandcamp.com and even purchase the full digital discography there. Where can people find out how to join this? What is the club called again? I'm sorry.
The Legion of Righteous Comrades. And I think there's still a way to join it. I think through the website, you can still join it. And then there's also the Aquabat Cadets Club, which is coming back, which we're going to do some vinyl releases just for the, you know, club members only, which I'm sure will open up at some point to others as well. So just check out the website.
And, the Cadets and Codgers, by the way.
Yeah, and Codgers. Yeah, the Codger, for sure.
Now, as your kids are getting older, is it harder to find inspiration for material for the Aquabats?
It is, and I think it could be the age. It could be my age, because I feel less and less like a kid. I don't feel old, and I think that's part of getting old, is you don't necessarily feel old. You feel lost. Like I feel a little lost. Like I don't really understand what kids are into or why they're into it. I don't get a lot of stuff. And I think that's part of getting older, is when we were kids, you know, our grandparents was like, how could you listen to that? That just sounds like, you know, someone dragging a bunch of drums behind a car. It doesn't even sound like music, you know? And I feel kind of the same way about a lot of the stuff that kids are into and my kids are into, whether that's the, you know, influencer they're watching on YouTube, 30-year-old guy playing Pokemon Go, who has millions of subscribers. I just scratch my head, like, because I feel lost, you know? It's like, I think that's part of getting older, is I still feel young. I still want to go skateboarding and surf and do all the fun stuff I used to do. I still want to write songs. I still love music. I still like collecting things. But then I just feel like, I'm on an island. I guess island. I guess island isn't a good term these days, but,
That always kind of, like, to me, that was always the separation when I was young, the separation with my parents. Yeah. I'll say an emotional kind of detachment when they would say, oh, that's not music. That's, you know, when it became judgmental.
Right.
With my kids, I always try to just embrace the bewilderment. What is it you're listening to? Okay, let me try some of that. Okay, here's something good I see in it. I'm not sure about this other thing, but at least I'm trying to learn.
Which I think is a different attitude, because we both can remember vividly our parents, like, you know, browbeating the stuff that we were into or what we were wearing, or, you know, the kind of things we were championing. They would, like, they didn't get it, and they weren't afraid to tell us that they don't think it was a good idea or it was dumb. So we definitely want to be open to what my kids are into. And I do give it a shot. I do give some things a shot, but just some of it, I just feel so disconnected. Like, so in a lot of ways, I think even just with rock and roll period, it's hard to feel like you're connecting with young people these days. Even though there is, you know, kind of a lo-fi garage punk kind of, there was a scene at least going on here in Orange County for a little bit, and in Southern California, where there are young people making rock and roll and playing real instruments and singing. But so much of music today is electronic and, you know, digital beats, and it's just what kids are used to. And don't get me wrong, I loved all that stuff when it came out in the 80s. I still have a huge love for, you know, TR-808s and, you know, all the, like, Juno 106 sounding songs from the 80s. But it just feels like, writing rock songs, it's not connecting like it used to with kids. And so I think for us, finding the way to connect even just amongst ourselves, like the energy between us, like just feeling good about something, because we have so many demos. We've written hundreds of half songs, and for any of our songs to actually make it onto a record is pretty awesome, actually. It's pretty awesome.
The writing process, I would imagine, begins with a theme, right? Whatever's in the zeitgeist, you try to pull these different things and build from there. Is that kind of?
I think that's the best way to write songs, is to have something you want to write about lyrically. But unfortunately, that's not always the way it goes down, because everyone in the band writes music. So everyone in the band is capable of coming up with a song without words, you know, just an instrumental track, except for me. Like, I'm not the best at that. Like, I can sit down with a guitar and strum something into a tape recorder and like play it back, or even four track it a little bit. I'm not that good at it. I think the thing that I'm good at is, you know, coming up with the ideas or the themes or how the words are going to fit together, the composition of the lyrics. And that's kind of been what I've been okay at. So coming up with themes isn't that hard, but themes that everyone wants to get behind, that's where it gets hard, because we're still pretty democratic as a band. And if I come up with an idea for a song thematically that everyone's like, nah, that's kind of stupid, I don't get it, then it just doesn't go anywhere. Right. But there's a ton of just instrumentals that are waiting for themes that we haven't been able to dial in yet. Because again, like you said, the best way to write songs is start with a theme and then put the music to it, and it goes quicker. It gets done. Like Crash is really great at writing songs because he comes up with an idea and then he writes the song. So Shark Fighter and No One Wants to Party at My House off the new record, like he'll come up with ideas and present them with music at the same time. So that's a little bit of the tricky part with the Aquabats, is we're also listening to each other instead of, well, I don't care what you think, I'm going to write it anyway. Like that doesn't happen too often in our band. We're all still very, if everyone's not in, then we don't do it.
With the Aquabats, you have this visual universe as well that has to be stored. It has to be tracked. For example, the battle tram. Where do you keep the battle tram? Where do you keep all the stuff that makes the Aquabats videos?
Good question. So we have a little kind of storage warehouse / think tank office that we've been keeping the battle tram in for a long time. And recently we went and shot some stuff up in Utah for these new YouTube-only episodes of the Super Show. Mm-hmm. And so we took the battle tram up there, and it's an old 70s motorhome. So let's just say it didn't come back. It's still there in Southern Utah at a storage unit, because we have to get it fixed. It's kind of broke down. But then a lot of the costumes and props and stuff so between some stuff here in Southern California and some stuff in the last location that we shot in, that's kind of where it is. But a lot of it's in storage. I'm a collector, so again, I have a hard time throwing stuff out or throwing stuff away.
Right.
So there's so much stuff that we still have that I've always thought, you know, like, well, this is going to come in handy someday, or someone's going to want it, or maybe we'll use it again. It's hard for me to throw stuff away, for sure.
So if you're driving the battle tram from Los Angeles to Utah, I mean, you must be catching a lot of people checking this out. You're right. You know, that must be fun. Awesome to drive.
It's super fun, because people, like, you know, they'll drive by, honk and wave and be taking pictures, or, you know, people will say, yeah, Aquabats every now and then. But a couple of years ago, we went to Comic-Con and with the battle tram. And we'd been going to Comic-Con every year for years and years and years, even before it was the coolest thing in the world or whatever. But the year that the show came out, we were like, let's drive the battle tram down there and drive around. And, you know, it'll be awesome, because people will be like, oh, yeah, the Aquabats. And, you know. So we're in full costume driving the battle tram down there in San Diego, where there's, a, you know, 150,000 people in an intersection practically. And we would drive by and people would just look at it like, what is that? What is that? And then every now and then there'd be like two people that would freak out. Aquabats, yeah! Jumping up and down out of like 200,000 people. There's like, you know, like small pockets of fans, which was encouraging, but at the same time, it was a little discouraging as well. Like, man, we've been doing it this long and no one knows what it is. I guess we still have street cred.
How hard is it not to break that fourth wall? When you go to Comic-Con, I imagine you have to be MC Bat Commander. You're on all the time, especially with kids around. You have to do that. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I do. I do. I break it a little bit. And I think it's just to let people know that there's a real guy in there that cares about them and appreciates them being mm-hmm. fans. That you know, I kind of like, you know, kind of like when you were a kid and your uncle or someone that you knew was Santa Claus and he was in character, but you knew it was somebody that
he gives you a wink. So both of you are
exactly. Yeah. So I'm pretty good at giving the wink. Like, hey, I'm still a real guy. And I'm thank you so much for coming out and being a part of it. Cause the Bat Commander, the character, he's a little bit of a jerk, a little bit of an ego jerk. So little bit.
Now, can you turn it on and off? Like right now, can we speak to the MC Bat Commander?
Sure, why not? What's up, man?
Hey, Commander, how are you today?
So good, bro. So good.
Hey,
what's going on?
Well, Bat Commander, there's a Karen over there, and she's not wearing a face mask, and she's touching all the shopping carts.
I've always said, don't go outside without your mask on. What's the deal, lady? Aquabats, let's go! Tackle the lady.
I got to tell you, Chris, it's been an absolute joy to speak with you. My kids and I, we all grew up on watching the Aquabats. I grew up listening to them, seeing some of the live shows, living in California. But as I started having kids and playing the episodes and watching them through their eyes has been an absolute joy. And even last night, my kids are now older. You know, they've graduated from Aquabats to now watching Borat. You know, but even going back to the Aquabats, my son turns to me last night. He says, "You know, this show is so much of who I am. It's goofy. It's monsters." And you know, he was very appreciative and understanding of the influence it had on him growing up. And I really got to thank you for that, because I think what you've created in Aquabats, and I mean, not to mention Yo Gabba Gabba, is absolutely wonderful and something I think the world really really needs.
That means everything. So thank you so much.
Don't worry.
Like, we doing it this long, we never would have thought, like, I mean, that was the big question, is like, are kids going to like this? Cause we like it, but are kids going to like it? So to hear that kids have been affected by it and love it and it helped shape them. That's, you know, yeah. That's more than the icing on the cake.
It really is a timeless sort of thing. It's interesting when I watched the preview for what was going to be the Aquabats in color TV show, like a pilot for a pilot.
Right.
Back in the day. It's very different than the Super Show. But that video was very well done. Did that become close to becoming a TV show back in the day?
Yeah, so that was another thing that, you know, was we were still signed with Golden Voice at the time, and we wanted to do a music video for one of the songs on Floating Eye of Death. And Paul Tillett and the Golden Voice Records, they gave us a small budget, and I thought, let's go shoot this little mini pilot for an Aquabats TV show, and then we'll just use the footage to cut a music video out of it. So we prioritized the Aquabats in color pilot thing, and we made it. And then we showed Paul and said, look what we made. And he was like, wait, I thought we were doing a music video. I'm like, we are. We're just going to re-edit the footage to make a video out of it. And then that was right when everything ended at Golden Voice Records. So we actually used our music video budget to make that little pilot. To try to sell it. I mean, that's how long ago we were trying to sell the show, is 1999. We were trying to get the show made, and for the Super Show to actually air in 2012, when we'd been literally trying to make it for over a decade, it's a miracle. Like, it was a miracle that it ever even happened, you mm-hmm. know? So, and I totally give all the credit to the fans of the band that kept us alive. Because if they weren't there, we would have probably given up on even trying to do it. So definitely, mm-hmm. When we would show up in 2004, 2005 to venues across the country, and there'd still be a couple hundred, 500 people there to see the Aquabats, it kept us going to say, like, mm-hmm. there's still people out there that like this, that could get it. Let's keep trying.
I remember watching that pilot for the pilot back in the late 90s when it was on the first version of the Aquabats website. I remember thinking, any TV production house that doesn't turn this into a show is an absolute fool. there's so much potential here.
It's funny because at the time, again, we were being very contrarian to what was really popular on TV at the time was reality TV. That was like, mm-hmm. that was like when reality TV took over. And so we would go play that to broadcasters, or we'd take it to networks, and they'd be like, what about a reality version of this? Like, what if you, and like, no, this is hyper reality. We want to do the anti-reality show. Like, we don't want to do, I don't care. Like, I don't want to do a reality. And so we had to kick against that for years. The fact that what was popular on TV was definitely not going to help us get the show sold, because it was hyper reality. We were doing, right. you know, Ultraman meets Batman meets Devo and the Power Rangers. And they wanted us to do like a confessional booth, you know, like today. And even in jest, we just didn't want to have anything to do with reality TV. Zero. It's not interesting because it's everywhere. It's everywhere, you know?
Was a super show possible mainly on the success of Yo Gabba Gabba?
Definitely. I mean, definitely without Yo Gabba Gabba, we would not have gotten it. And interestingly enough, one of the first people we pitched Yo Gabba Gabba to when we had a pilot for it was Disney. And one of the executives at Disney was a junior executive at the time. He loved Yo Gabba Gabba. He got it. He was like, this is it. Let's go. And he brought us in and we met with all the bigwigs there at Disney. And the bigwigs said, you know, this is a cute show, but it's just not Disney. It's not us. And this executive that brought us in, we just saw it on his face. He was crushed. And he couldn't believe they didn't get it. And so later, a couple of years later, he calls us up and says, hey, it's Ted. And I'm over here at a new network called The Hub, and we can do whatever we want. I want you to bring in another show. I know Yo Gabba Gabba has already sailed down the road. Bring whatever you got. And we brought him in the Aquabats, and he was like, this is amazing. Let's do it. So kudos to his name's Ted Biaselli. He's over at Netflix now, but kudos to Ted because he brought it into Margaret Lesh at The Hub, and they were like, this is amazing, and there's nothing like this on TV right now, so let's do it. And I love it when every now and then you'll get really some really creative executives that they'll want to do something different and take a chance. And you'd think there'd be more of that happening, but you know, it's still kind of par for the course for networks and executives to want to do what they did on at record labels. And you know, it's like, oh, Nirvana's big, we need to sign the next 100 grunge bands, or you know what I mean. Networks do the same thing. They just do the same thing. And so
at that point, were the Aquabats a going concern? Was it that was still going, or did you have to call the guys and say, hey, you know, I know it's been a while since we got together, but I got some interesting news?
Well, we were still going. I think we, you know, we had it was just prior to, because we did another pilot in 2009, which was in between one of the seasons of Yo Gabba Gabba. So like the first season of Yo Gabba Gabba, we shot another pilot for the Aquabats. It's called the Aquabats Super Show. It's not the Aquabats in Color.
Is that the one where you have the band at the beginning and the end? The band is kind of shepherding the different segments along?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's the one we shot in 2009. And we were still playing shows when we had time. And then, you know, High Five Soup came out in 2011. So we were still like doing the band and trying to put records out. It just, Gabba kept us really busy. And a lot of the guys worked on Yo Gabba Gabba, Ricky Fitness and Eagle Bones. And, you know, we bring Jimmy in all the time to play saxophone on parts. And Crash even worked the season one building sets. So we were all really involved with Yo Gabba Gabba.
So Christian, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing with us those stories and the background for the Aquabats. Again, I absolutely love this band. And I would encourage folks to go check them out at theaquabats.com. It's very family friendly. So any one of you who have dad bods like myself and some youngsters around the house, you could enjoy it on multiple levels. Theaquabats.com, the new album is Kooky Spooky in Stereo. And it sounds very promising that there is more Aquabats in the pipeline here. It sounds like there's more music coming, and I'm starting to see more episodes on the YouTube channel. So I'd also encourage folks to head over to YouTube, to the Aquabats channel, subscribe to that. Again, the videos are great. They're family friendly and they're really fun on multiple levels. Again, Christian, thank you so much for all you do. Yo Gabba, the Aquabats and everything else. It really is a marvelous set of universes you've created, and look forward to seeing what else you guys have in store for us.
Thanks so much, man. That means a lot, and it was great talking to you. So thanks again.
There we go. Mr. Christian Jacobs, the MC Bat Commander himself. And of course, I am Aqua Geezer number 4285, reporting for duty, here to tell you that Kooky Spooky in Stereo is available now. It's on vinyl. You can go to theaquabats.com, or of course, a myriad of other places you could find it. Also, subscribe to their YouTube channel. All the episodes of the Super Show are up there. Plus, they're doing a bunch of bonus stuff as well. And it is just a great channel to subscribe to and to see all the content as it comes through. So again, thank you very much, Christian. And we look forward to the continuing expanding universe of the Aquabats. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Tweet about them, put them on Facebook, put them on Instagram. And of course, feel free to write us a wonderful review up at Apple iTunes or Spotify or wherever. Just sign in, give us a 5 out of 5, a 10 out of 10. Say something nice, make us blush. That is always appreciated. We'll be back with a brand new episode shortly. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.